Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Emergency and Critical Care Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in small animal surgery, Rachel Hattersley. Thank you, Rachel. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for listening to the webinar. Today, we're going to have a look at how we best approach dealing with trauma canines who come through the clinic. So this presentation hopefully will allow us to develop a systematic approach to looking at body systems and also how to deal with the sort of immediate emergency problems that you may see in these patients. So the first step generally for these patients when they come into the waiting room is an immediate triage. This may be visual and it may be that a nurse can do this for you, but the aim of this would be to determine if it's safe for you to consult with the patient or if the patient should be removed from the owner while you consult with them. So the things that I would normally suggest that we look for are, is the patient conscious and responsive and ambulatory? Is there any signs of active hemorrhage? Any signs of any breathing difficulties? So looking at respiratory rate and effort, and particularly for our brachycephalic patients, looking for increased inspiratory noise, looking at heart rate, pulse quality, mucous membrane colour and capillary refill time. And at this point, if we decide to remove the patient from the owner, we need to decide, do we need to analgese at this point? The answer to that is normally yes, and also is supplemental oxygen required? So at this juncture, an opioid would be the most appropriate analgesic to give, and we would normally look to give something like methadone. You can also then add in things like ketamine as a constant rate infusion and also lidocaine, which is particularly useful if there are concurrent ventricular arrhythmias. I would definitely recommend you steer clear of giving a non-steroidal in trauma patients until hydration status has been confirmed because of the risk of renal damage. So our initial step with these patients is going to be to do a primary survey to look at the essential body systems, and they would be the respiratory system, cardiovascular system, neurological system and the urinary system. And we'll go through one of those, each of those in turn. So signs of respiratory compromise would include dyspnea or tachypnea, increased abdominal effort, stertor, stridor or wheezing, abducted elbows, mouth breathing, particularly in cats, is a big concern, and cyanotic mucous membranes. So for most patients with respiratory issues, providing supplemental oxygen will be a sensible thing to do. We're going to minimise how much we handle these patients. Analgesing them is a very good thing to do because if they're painful, that's going to further restrict their respiratory pattern. And maintaining them in sternal recumbency will prevent collapse of a dependent lung lobe. So keeping them in sternal is a good idea. Thoracic auscultation, we potentially could be looking at pleural fluid if we have a hemothorax, and that may manifest itself as dull lung sounds ventrally. A pneumothorax, absence of lung sounds dorsally if it's a small volume, although if it's a larger volume pneumothorax, you may not hear lung sounds on in the thorax at all. And pulmonary crackles or wheezing associated with parenchymal disease, such as pulmonary contusions. And if possible, to gain intravenous access at this point. There are three main ways that we can consider providing supplemental oxygen for our patients. We can look at using a face mask and realistically, the maximum fractional inspired oxygen we're going to achieve is about 50 to 60%, even with very high flow rates. Nasal prongs or nasal catheter, we can achieve a higher fractional inspired oxygen concentration using slightly lower flows, but even so, the high flows generally aren't well tolerated in these patients because of the sensation of the oxygen passing through the nasal cavity. And if these are to be used more than short term, then we would want to look to humidify our gas to prevent irritation of the nasal passages. And we can also look to use oxygen cages or incubators, and again, achieving a fractional inspired oxygen of 50 to 60%. We need to be very careful we don't end up with hyperthermic patients, though, if we're using these. Assessment of the cardiovascular system. We can look for mental states. So is the patient ambulatory? Is it collapsed? Mucous membrane colour, capillary refill time, heart rate, pulse quality, the presence and quality of the digital pulses, and also the temperature of extremities. So if a patient is collapsed with very cold extremities, that would absolutely support compromise of the cardiovascular system. So if possible, attach a continuous ECG to these patients. If safe to do so, we would get some baseline blood work, so PCBTP, electrolytes, urea, creatinine and glucose. Lactate is nice to have, but honestly, it probably doesn't necessarily change what we do. And I think, you know, serially monitoring lactate doesn't necessarily always add a huge amount to our diagnostics. So I think we should only be serially monitoring lactate if we intend to do something about the result when we get it. And checking blood pressure is a very useful thing to do, and there are three ways that we can do that, either using oscillometric blood pressure, so using the machines, using Doppler, or by placing an arterial line. And there are some figures there as to the levels that ideally we would like our numbers to be above. So we may see abnormal cardiovascular parameters because of reduced systemic vascular resistance, and that may either be because we have a hypovolemic patient because they've hemorrhaged, or because we have systemic inflammatory response syndrome and we've got peripheral vasodilation. We may have a patient who has concurrent structural cardiac disease, or if there has been a period of hypoxia after the trauma, we may have hypoxic damage to cardiac muscle, which can certainly set up arrhythmias. And also pain. The majority of these patients are going to be in a significant amount of pain, and that can certainly contribute to our abnormal cardiovascular parameters. So how do we stabilise the cardiovascular system? Initially, we're going to reach for the crystalloids, and they are the mainstay of initial fluid resuscitation. Ideally, we're going to use a balanced electrolyte solution, so Hartmann's or Plasmalite. And rather than putting patients on a certain mil per kilo per hour, I would recommend that you give 10 to 20 mil per kilo boluses over 15 minutes and monitor the heart rate. Monitor heart rate, so response to fluid therapy. If we have a patient who's tachycardic and we give fluids and the tachycardia reduces, that would support a diagnosis of hypovolemia. And we want to avoid large volumes of sodium chloride because they will lead to metabolic acidosis. And we can use hypertonic saline, but that must be followed with an isotonic solution. And monitoring heart rate is the, I think, best and simplest way of monitoring your response to fluid therapy. We can also look at blood pressure as well. In patients who've had significant blood loss, then we can also look at using a colloid, bearing in mind that 75% of the crystalloid volume that you give will end up in the interstitium probably within an hour of being given. So colloids are have much larger molecules and therefore will stay in the circulation much longer. Voluven was the sort of go-to colloid that we were using for a long time, and then there was a large-scale study in human medicine looking at the use of starches in trauma patients, and they found an evidence of increased risk of acute kidney injury in humans, particularly those who were septic, and currently now starches are only licensed for use in hemorrhage patients in humans. Starches generally are larger molecules, so they stay in the circulation longer than the gelatins. So I think there is still a place for them to be used in veterinary medicine. Gelatins are the mainstay for fluid resuscitation with colloids in human medicine at the moment. They are smaller molecules than the starches. In people, there can be issues with hypersensitivity reactions, although that's not something that's particularly well documented in canine patients. And therefore, at the moment, probably gelatins are also our go-to. colloid in these patients whilst further work is being done on the effects of starches within the human field. In patients who have lost a significant volume of blood, then we can look at giving blood products, so we can give fresh frozen plasma, and we would normally give 10 to 20 mils per kilo. In patients where we're using packed cell transfusions, combining a fresh frozen plasma transfusion with a packed cell transfusion is often very useful. But the fresh frozen plasma does not contain any platelets, so it's not a perfect solution. Whole blood obviously has the benefit of containing platelets and clotting factors, but carries the extra work of sourcing an available donor and then a procedure for the donor as well in terms of giving the blood. So for the majority of hemorrhage patients, if you've lost whole blood, replacing with whole blood is the best thing to do. But if you don't have availability of donors, then giving packed cells plus or minus a frozen fresh frozen plasma transfusion will suffice in the majority of these patients. So what are our initial goals for resuscitation of the respiratory and cardiovascular system? So we're looking for normalisation of heart rate and the restoration of good peripheral pulses. We'd like our mean arterial blood pressure to be over 65 millimetres of mercury. We would like urine output to be over 0.5 mL/kg/h, averaged over about a 4-hour period. And ideally, we would like our lactate levels to be down below 2. Neurological assessment. So severe changes in mentation, such as an obtunded patient or a patient who's seizuring, may indicate the need for further investigation or stabilisation. So I would normally look to do an assessment of basic cranial nerves. If the patient is ambulatory, then the likelihood of a very severe spinal injury is low. If the patient is non-ambulatory, then we ask the question, does the patient have voluntary movement? If the patient has voluntary movement of the limbs, then deep pain will be intact. We only need to assess for deep pain in patients who have no voluntary movement. And the other thing that we should do is check for segmental spinal reflexes, so at least to check the withdrawal reflexes in addition to checking for either a voluntary movement or deep pain if appropriate. Certainly in patients who have had a road traffic accident and sustained a large amount of trauma, there is a real risk for urinary tract damage, and we would like to monitor urine output both from the possibility of urinary tract damage and also because it's a good marker for us in terms of assessing hydration status. So in patients who are going to be recumbent and in patients who you feel are have sustained significant trauma, and placement of an indwelling Foley catheter can help you both in terms of maintaining patient comfort and also in terms of being able to monitor urine output. And then you can look at measuring the fluid that goes in, so your intravenous fluid and also any oral fluid intake, versus the fluid out, so respiratory losses, the volume of urine being produced, and any loss associated with vomiting or diarrhea, to allow you to determine whether you've achieved an adequate balance and hydration status. If urine output is low, the first thing we would normally do is to give a crystalloid bolus, and as we said, rather than giving a certain mil per kilo per hour, we would look to give a 5 to 10 mil per kilo bolus over about 15 minutes. If that's not successful, then we can then add in a colloid as well. We do infrequently give furosemide to increase urine production, but for the majority of patients, that would not be necessary. So we've assessed our initial body systems. Where do we go now? We are going to then make a problem list of the issues that we have with that patient, and then we need to sit down and prioritise which of those problems is the most important. So, for instance, it may be that a diaphragmatic rupture is going to be it will be prioritised over a femoral fracture. And then we need to make a list of the diagnostics that will allow us to make the swiftest and most efficient diagnosis of the various problems that the patient may have. So our secondary survey is where we start to do some diagnostic tests. It may be that we want to do some further blood work, have a neurological assessment, thoracic and or abdominal ultrasound, radiography, and advanced imaging if there is availability. So what issues can we potentially see with the respiratory system? And we can see hemothorax, pneumothorax, pulmonary contusions, compromise of the thoracic wall, so rib fractures or potentially defects within the muscle of the thoracic wall and potentially injury to the diaphragm. Hemothorax is best diagnosed on thoracic ultrasound. So if you can see pleural fluid on thoracic ultrasound, then to sample it and check a PCV if the fluid that you sample appears very hemorrhagic and compare it to systemic PCV. If you have a systemic PCV, say of 25, and you have pleural fluid that has a PCV of, say, 18, that would be very much supportive of a hemothorax. And you should position for your thoracocentesis the needle on the basis of what you're expecting to find. So fluid will often sit ventrally, whereas air will often sit more dorsally within the thorax. Pneumothorax, most commonly diagnosed with radiography. So lung markings should extend to the edge of the lung fields in a normal thoracic radiograph. We can see in the radiograph on the left that there is a significant pneumothorax with collapse of the lungs. And on the lateral radiograph on the right, we can see elevation of the cardiac silhouette some distance above the sternum due to a pneumothorax. So pneumothorax initially can be managed using thoracocentesis. You can use lidocaine as a ring block around the entry point of the needle if you feel the patient's not stable enough to be sedated. And we would normally look to insert our needle with the bevel facing outwards at intercostal spaces 8 or 9. If we needle drain and the air either reforms very quickly or we can't achieve a negative seal, then we may need to consider placement of a thoracostomy tube, which obviously would require general anaesthesia. And very rarely in some patients who've had airway rupture, it may be that you will not gain control of that chest without surgical intervention. Our options for chest drains are either trocar drains or there are now a number of Seldinger over the wire drains available on the veterinary market, which can be a little bit less daunting to place than the trocar drains. Once the thoracostomy tube's in place, these patients need very close observation. I would recommend that there's a rigid Buster collar in place all the time, because if the patient chews the thoracostomy tube, then death will ensue relatively quickly. And I normally base drainage frequency depending on what you're expecting to find and how much of it you're expecting to find. So if you have a significant air leak, you may be looking to drain these patients very frequently. If you're looking for fluid production, it might be that you only need to drain every 6 to 8 to 12 hours. And it's important to ensure correct asepsis when handling the drain, as pyrothorax is a potential complication of having a drain going into the chest cavity. In patients who are over 20 kilos who have a significant pneumothorax, we can consider the use of a Heimlich valve. And a Heimlich valve works by when the pressure in the thoracic cavity exceeds atmospheric pressure, air is allowed to escape through this one-way valve. So it's a piece of tubing within a plastic cylinder. It can be quite large and cumbersome. And if there's any fluid, then the valve will stick together once wet. So it's important that they're monitored very closely, because if there is pleural fluid as well, a Heimlich valve is probably not an appropriate thing to be using. Pulmonary contusions are very common following road traffic accidents, even in patients who don't have a hemothorax or a pneumothorax. And there are several mechanisms of injury that can be seen after thoracic trauma that will lead to pulmonary contusions. The actual physical transmission of mechanical force to the thoracic wall, inward displacement of the thoracic wall causing a crushing injury of the lung parenchyma, and also laceration of the lung parenchyma as well. And damaged lung parenchyma has reduced clearance of fluid in cells, thus further compromising oxygenation within the alveoli. How do we diagnose pulmonary contusions? Well, I think in the majority of road traffic accident patients, we should probably assume that they're there until proven otherwise. Radiographically, pulmonary contusions will often get worse for the first 24 hours after the injury. So if you see a patient very soon post road traffic accident, you may not necessarily see significant signs of contusions, but if you radiograph that patient 24 hours later, then you may well then see changes that you didn't see before. In patients where we can see radiographic evidence of pulmonary contusions, we would normally look to see an alveolar pattern, and you may well also see air bronchograms. If you're able to do arterial blood gas analysis, the arterial oxygen levels should be 5 times the fractional inspired oxygen, and therefore if you're giving mask oxygen supplementation, we're looking for an arterial oxygen level of at least 300 millimetres. Mercury. Pulmonary contusions are unfortunately not necessarily that easy to manage. They're not something we can just remove. So maintaining these patients in sternal recumbency and ensuring that they're adequately analgesed will improve chest excursions and potentially help to reopen any alveoli which have collapsed. In people, thoracic physiotherapy plays an important role in the management of patients who have pulmonary contusions, and certainly getting patients up and about walking as soon as is appropriate will help to move secretions up the mucociliary escalator. Oxygen supplementation, as we've already discussed, we can look at using bronchodilators such as terbutaline, and in very severe patients or patients who are very severely affected, we can look to do mechanical ventilation. Although in this very small study of 10 dogs, the survival to discharge was less than 50% if ventilation was required. And ventilation can be very costly, often looking at somewhere between £500 to £1,000 a day for management of a patient on a ventilator. In patients with diaphragmatic rupture, as we've already discussed, provision of supplemental oxygen, intravenous access and analgesia, relatively easily diagnosed either with radiography or with ultrasound, looking for loss of the diaphragmatic contour and the presence of abdominal organs in the incorrect position. So we can see a couple of radiographs here of diaphragmatic ruptures and also a CT showing displacement of the small intestine through into the left side of the thorax. And here we have a dorsoventral view of the thorax, a patient with a left-sided diaphragmatic rupture. We can see that the fundus is displaced cranially and also the spleen. And the same patient at surgery, we can just see the edge here of the circumferential tear within the diaphragm. It always used to be that there was a lot of discussion about when was the most appropriate time to operate diaphragmatic ruptures, and the current thinking actually is as soon as it's stable, safe to do so, and the patient is stable, then we should proceed with surgery, because there is a risk both of to the lungs if they're chronically atelectic, an increased risk of re-expansion pulmonary edema when the hernia is repaired, and also the fact that if there are gaseous viscous or a gaseous viscous passes through the diaphragm into the thorax and then becomes stuck. So in practical terms, if the stomach goes through and then gets stuck, then you can get further gas distension of the stomach and that can become a life-threatening emergency. The real key to surgical management of diaphragmatic rupture is to be as prepared as possible for the surgery and prior to anaesthesia. So we keep the patient in sternal recumbency for as long as possible. We try and clip as much of the patient as possible, and I would also clip the caudal aspect of the sternum in case you needed to do a caudal sternotomy. And we normally maintain these patients on a tilt to encourage any abdominal organs to stay in the abdomen rather than herniating through into the chest. In patients who have had more chronic diaphragmatic ruptures, there can be concern with regards to re-expansion and pulmonary edema. The reason that we see that is if we have rapid re-expansion of collapsed vascular beds, we get reperfusion injury, which leads to pulmonary edema.
So in patients with more chronic diaphragmatic rupture, with very collapsed lung, if you can see that through the diaphragmatic rupture as you're repairing it, then we can place a chest drain as an open procedure. You're able to see into the chest, so you should be able to place it and actually feel where it's going. And then I would drain only enough air to be able to extubate the patient, and then we would remove 2 to 5 mils every 2 hours until a seal is achieved, depending on patient size. Ideally, we would provide oxygen supplementation for these patients in recovery and to keep them in sternal recumbency and to prevent atelectasis of the dependent portion of lung if they were in lateral recumbency. And if you have a patient who becomes hypoxic post-extubation, I would recommend considering a conscious chest radiograph because you may have some remaining pneumothorax. And as we've previously discussed, ensuring adequate analgesia is provided will ensure that you have as normal chest excursions as possible. The survival rate for diaphragmatic rupture is actually pretty good, so 82 to 93% survival rate. And if we do lose patients, it's usually secondary to either a hemothorax, pneumothorax, or pulmonary edema. Other complications are infrequently reported, including ascites, gastric ulceration, esophagitis, megaesophagus, and obviously there is always the possibility of recurrence of the rupture. We can also see body wall rupture in patients who've sustained significant trauma, and the inguinal, prepubic, intercostal and paracostal locations are the most common. At least 50%, if not more, of these patients will have concurrent soft tissue orthopaedic injuries. It's important to note that the hernia may not necessarily be obvious on your initial assessment, depending on what's been herniated through, and therefore the use of contrast radiography can be very useful. And we would obviously also always radiograph the thorax, because if you have enough trauma to rupture the abdominal wall, you may well also have a diaphragmatic rupture. So we have a patient here on the left that has an abdominal wall rupture secondary to a dogfight, and we can see a mentum there hanging out of the holes. And on the right, we have a patient who has an abdominal wall rupture secondary to a road traffic accident. You can see there that there is some swelling in the left inguinal region. And here is a cat who has a ventral body wall rupture secondary to a road traffic accident. We can see small intestine sat within the subcutaneous space. And we have a prepubic tendon rupture in a cat here, who you can see it has an acetabular fracture repaired, that prepubic tendon rupture has allowed bladder herniation. So ideally, we would normally explore abdominal wall ruptures via a midline celiotomy to allow exploration of all abdominal organs. We would reduce the hernial contents and debride any necrotic or friable tissues, and then use either polypropylene or polydoxinone to oppose the hernia in anatomical layers. We really would only use mesh if there were no autogenous tissue options, so if there's no muscle that can be brought into the area. If you do need to use mesh, then the edges of the mesh should be double thickness, and you can attach it to the surrounding musculature using either simple interrupted or horizontal mattress sutures. The reason we prefer not to use mesh if possible is because it does increase the risk of wound healing complications and infection, and if possible, suture amend your defect prior to print of the mesh to prevent adhesions of abdominal contents to the mesh. In patients with traumatic paracostal rupture, be aware that you will likely end up in the chest cavity and therefore ventilation may be required. And if there is significant damage to the peripheral diaphragm, the diaphragm can be advanced. So it's always the priority to restore a sealed chest cavity. So it's possible that you may end up turning a coulothoracic defect into a cranial abdominal defect, because that's an easier thing to manage. These patients will likely require a chest drain, and it may be that you can utilise an autogenous muscle flap such as the latissimus dorsi to close defects in this area. So here we have a surgical photo. The black arrow denotes the the diaphragm, which is being advanced because of a defect in the caudal thoracic and cranial abdominal wall. Prepubic tendon ruptures, probably one of the more common things that we see in cats, but we can also see them in dogs. And again, we're looking to reduce anal contents via eventual midline cerebellar incision. Sometimes there will be sufficient soft tissue remaining on the pubis, and there you can do a soft tissue closure. But more commonly, you would need to pre-drill holes for your suture in the cranial brim of the pubis to facilitate attachment of the musculature of the body wall to the pubis. Usually, we do not need to use mesh in these ruptures. I think patients who have had body wall ruptures are generally very uncomfortable, and the use of local anaesthetic catheters for diffusion of local anaesthetic into the wound can be very helpful. These are flexible fenestrated catheters which are placed at or near the site of surgery, and you can use bupivacaine or lidocaine to supply local analgesia directly to the area, which allows you to reduce your reliance on systemic analgesics such as opioids and their potential side effects such as nausea and sedation. So I think for body wall ruptures, it's definitely worth considering using these. They're not that expensive. They can be easily sourced through most of the veterinary suppliers, particularly they're in the veterinary instrumentation catalogue. In terms of urinary tract rupture, trauma to the kidneys and the ureters actually is relatively rare, although it's not uncommon to see fairly significant retroperitoneal hemorrhage in these patients. Because the kidneys and ureters sit in a relatively protected position, it's unusual for us to see rupture of either a kidney or a ureter. So the bladder is the most common site of rupture, and it may be that initially we don't see very many signs because there may not be that much urine leakage at that point. And it's important to note that sometimes animals with a bladder rupture may still appear to urinate normally or have a palpable bladder initially. Urethral rupture leads to urine leakage either into the abdomen, if it's the very cranial aspect of the urethra, or into the intrapelvic soft tissues, which would lead to pain, edema and bruising. So in patients where we suspect a urinary tract rupture, we would be particularly interested in knowing what the creatinine and the potassium were doing. If there is significant hyperkalemia, it would be worth attaching an ECG to this patient. And ideally, we need to initiate fluid therapy in conjunction with establishing some kind of temporary urine drainage, which may be an indwelling urethral catheter if it can be placed. We can also consider placement of a cystostomy tube if a urethral catheter cannot be placed. And short-term peritoneal dialysis is also reported using a Jackson Pratt drain. For patients who do have a urinary tract rupture, if they're left long enough, we will see progressive hyperkalemia. And as you know, over time, we can see changes on the ECG, initially looking at spike T waves through to more significant arrhythmias. So in patients who have who are hyperkalemic, it may well be that fluid therapy in conjunction with establishing urine drainage may resolve the hyperkalemia. But if the serum hyperkalemia exceeds 7.5 millimoles per litre, then we need to think about how we help deal with that on a medical basis. So we can give insulin and 50% dextrose solution. So we are there relying on the insulin to encourage the cells to uptake potassium as they uptake the glucose. We can also give a 10% calcium gluconate solution. The important thing to remember about the calcium gluconate solution is what the calcium is doing is it's stabilizing the cardiac membrane. So it reduces your risk of arrhythmia associated with the hyperkalemia, but it doesn't actually necessarily reduce the serum potassium that you have. So usually you would need to do both of these things rather than doing one or the other. And in patients where we can't establish urine drainage using an indwelling urethral catheter, and certainly in some urethral ruptures it will not be possible to catheterise the urethra, then we can consider placing a flank cystostomy tube, which actually is a relatively quick procedure, similar approach to a CAT's bay. So we make a small flank approach through the body wall, and usually because the bladder is distended, the bladder is relatively easy to identify. We place a purse string in the bladder wall and pass our Foley catheter through the purse string and then inflate the balloon and tie our purse string. And these can be placed in 15-20 minutes and are a very effective way of establishing urine drainage. They would normally stay in for at least a week to 10 days to allow an adhesion to form between the bladder and the body wall, so that when they are removed we don't then end up with a uroabdomen. So definitive diagnosis of urinary tract rupture is usually made on either with the identification of free abdominal fluid or with contrast radiography. If there is free abdominal fluid, we can compare creatinine levels in the abdominal fluid to serum creatinine levels. And creatinine is a relatively big molecule, so once it is in the abdomen, it's too big to be reabsorbed across membranes within into the circulation. Urea is a much smaller molecule and therefore will re-equilibrate across membranes. Whereas once serum creatinine is, once creatinine is in the abdominal fluid, it stays in the abdominal fluid. So if you have a patient who has free abdominal fluid and the creatinine levels in the abdominal fluid are twice those of serum creatinine levels, that would be considered to be pathognomonic for a uroabdomen. Contrast radiography, we can look at both positive contrast cystogram and also retrogrades are very useful for looking at urethral damage. So here is a patient who, as you can see, has had a pelvic fracture. And pelvic fractures always increase my suspicion for the possibility of urinary tract trauma. And in this patient, the bladder looks very much to be intact. But when we did contrast radiography, we can see that, yeah, the bladder is intact, but there was rupture within the prostatic urethra. And subsequently, this patient did develop a uroabdomen. So contrast radiography is very important. Just because you can see an intact bladder on a radiograph doesn't absolutely confirm that there can't therefore be a urethral trauma. So if we do suspect bladder rupture, then we would approach that via exploratory cerebrotomy and debride and suture the tear. I tend to also mentalise the area as well. If there's concern that there may be infection within the urine for some reason, then you can also place an abdominal drain as well. And here is a patient with a small bladder rupture just here. And this tear can be debrided and closed with several simple interrupted sutures. Urethral rupture, partial tears can often be successfully managed using an indwelling urethral catheter. Please make sure you choose an appropriate catheter because they'll often have to stay in for 10 to 14 days. So you'd be looking at using a silicon catheter, not a rigid Jackson CAT catheter. And I would normally look to repeat a retrograde in these patients 7 to 10 days out from placement of the catheter to confirm that the tear has healed and the owners need to be made aware there is the possibility of stricture formation. In patients who have a complete urethral rupture, surgical management can be considered. It depends on the location of the rupture, but generally some kind of urethrostomy procedure is required. And in patients who have spinal trauma, the most reliable prognostic indicator is the presence or absence of deep pain. So if we have a patient who is deep pain negative and radiographically you can see a spinal fracture, the prognosis for functional recovery in those patients is actually very poor. So only around 5% if the patient is deep pain negative. A suspicion for significant spinal trauma can be made on neurological examination. We can also look to do plain server radiographs, obviously being very careful about how these patients are handled. We're looking at around about a 72% sensitivity for plain radiography to pick up spinal trauma. CT is considered to be the gold standard for assessment of spinal fractures, and also allows for planning of placement of implants. It's important to note that a lack of displacement of the fracture at the time of imaging does not preclude that there's been a larger displacement at the time of injury. If you can see 100% displacement of the spinal canal radiographically, then that warrants a very poor prognosis. And what we mean by this is if the spinal canal here is displaced more than its width above the other portion of the spinal canal, then that would carry a very poor prognosis. Spinal surgery is indicated for compressive or unstable lesions, and we would consider an unstable lesion to be one where more than one compartment of the spinal column is unstable. So there's the dorsal, middle and ventral compartments of the spinal column. We would still want to manage life-threatening injuries first, so respiratory injuries and pulmonary contusions. We'd want to make sure we'd performed adequate cardiovascular resuscitation. And the majority of spinal fractures would either be managed using pins, screws and PMMA, so cement, or using contourable locking plates. And certainly some of the patients who we see following road traffic accident will have very significant skin wounds, some of which can look very dramatic and be very distressing for the owner. To talk a little bit about how we decide what we close and what we don't. Generally for all skin wounds, once a patient's been stabilised, we would look to clip and clean a large area around the wound, remove any gross debris, using either glove fingers or sterile instruments, and then we would pack the wound with a water-soluble lubricant such as KY jelly. And then we're going to lavage the wound thoroughly with copious volumes of either sterile saline or Hartmann's solution. And if there's any obviously dead tissue, then this is a good time to debride it. If there's any tissue that you think may be viable but you're not quite sure, I think whether or not you make the decision to remove it depends on whether or not you intend to close the wound at that point, or whether or not you have time to wait to see. If you're managing the wound as an open wound, if there is questionable tissue, then I think the best thing to do is to wait and see if that tissue survives or not, rather than debriding aggressively. If you have a wound that you need to close, then you may well have to debride more aggressively. So with road traffic accidents, we quite commonly see these kinds of degloving injuries, I always feel better once they're clipped and cleaned appropriately. This will really help you with your wound management and also in terms of keeping the wound clean. So if we're making a decision about whether or not to close the wound, I think the first question that we have to ask is, does the wound require exploration? Does the wound definitely require closure? So say, for instance, if we have a wound that's entering into the chest, then actually that is a wound that has to be closed. We can't allow that to be managed as an open wound. Do we have enough tissue to close? And how viable is the tissue that we're proposing to use when we close? And is ongoing debridement likely to be required? If it's not in an essential location do you think ongoing debridement is likely to be required, then certainly managing a wound as an open wound for a period of time before closure is a sensible thing to consider. When we consider what we can use to dress, in contaminated wounds where we want to encourage granulation tissue formation, we can look to use a wet to dry dressing. So we're going to soak some sterile swabs in some saline and pack them into the wound. They can be quite painful to change because they will debride the surface of the wound. So sedation should be considered when changing a wet to dry. And the picture that you can see on the right of the screen is a French bulldog who was hit by a car and had a sort of a large wound over the cranial aspect of the shoulder that we were managing initially with wet to dry dressings, which were held in place with a tie over. Alevin is always a sensible choice, I think, for wounds. The Alevin dressings will promote a moist wound environment and granulation tissue formation. In patients with slightly more chronic wounds that you think there may be infection, we can look at using alginate dressings or silver dressings as well. And in very large defects, for those of you who have access to vacuum-assisted wound closure, then that can be something that's very useful in these cases. The machine produces a set level of negative pressure vacuum into the wound, is continually draining discharge from the wound, and also encourages granulation tissue formation as well. And I think for wounds over the torso and the proximal limb, then a tie over dressing is very useful. So again, our French bulldog, you can see, has big loops of suture in the edges of the wound, and that's so that we can put a dressing on and place some rolled up exploratory laparotomy swabs over the top, and then use those suture loops to lace over the top of the exploratory laparotomy swabs and to hold it in place. And that means that then it's a difficult area to dress with a normal limb dressing because we can't get that high. So it's an easy way, doesn't restrict movement too much. So this is the VAC dressing. This is a Great Dane with a large wound over the dorsal cervical region. You can see in this photo that we've tacked down the edges of the skin to the edges of the wound to prevent retraction. And then a special foam with a specific pore size is packed into the wound, and sticky back plastic, for want of a better description, placed over the top. And then this white area that we can see here in the middle is our vacuum. So this then connects to the machine that produces the vacuum. This is a patient who presented following a road traffic accident, who had a concurrent brachial plexus avulsion, and we can see a very large skin wound here, and there was a small defect in the caudal thoracic wall down in here. And you can see there is very significant debris and contamination in this patient. So we spent quite a long time cleaning this before surgery. This dog had to go to surgery because we had a thoracic wall defect. And also it's a very large wound, so it probably would have been quite a difficult one to manage as an open wound. Also, once we cleaned the debris, actually, we had quite a healthy looking tissue bed there. This is our wound at the end of surgery. We had a closed suction drain in this, which you can just see here. So this is our closed suction drain here, and we've also got a wound diffusion catheter in this patient as well, so that we can deliver local anaesthetic into the wound. And this is the patient when she came back for thoracic limb amputation, because unfortunately a brachial plexus avulsion did not improve. And you can see we had a small area at the very tip of this long flap that did not survive, and that healed by second intention healing. And actually this dog did very well. So I think it's always advisable to warn an owner that you should expect you may lose some of the skin that you suture if you're doing a primary closure in an acute wound. And if you have the option to wait to debride tissues which are of questionable viability, then I think it's a good thing to do that. But in these very, very big wounds, that may not be as easy a thing to achieve. Whereas with the degloving injuries over the limb, actually you may well have time to wait. And finally, we come to musculoskeletal trauma, usually the last injury to be addressed, because usually they're not life-threatening. And also orthogonal radiography and surgical management usually requires general anaesthesia. So we should look to appropriately dress unstable fractures if they're distal to the elbow or stifle. The one time that we would suggest that fractures are addressed more quickly would be those either which are open fractures or those which are articular fractures. So that's in a very brief rundown of how we would expect to approach a road traffic accident patient, and we're happy to take any questions at this point. Thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Rachel for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.